So, last week, I presented this idea that the world and the church are telling two different stories about the world. And those different stories are at the root of a lot of the tension between the church and the world. So the story that we tell, whether you're in the church or if you're in the world, whatever story, big story we're telling, is answering essentially four questions. Who are we? What does it mean to be human? What is a human being? Number two, where are we? How do we make sense of the world that we live in? Three, what's wrong? Every culture believes there's something wrong, that we're going somewhere. And then fourth, what is the solution? How then should we live in light of what's wrong and where we're supposed to, or where we are and who we are? Story is one of three main components that we talked about last week that comprises a worldview. You have story. Does anybody remember what the other two were that we talked about? Symbol, symbols, and praxis. Story, symbols, and praxis. The Bible has a story that it is inviting us to believe that answers these questions. And Genesis 1 through 3 is a key critical text for understanding who we are, where we are, what's wrong, and what the solution is. So this morning, we're going to start digging into Genesis 1 through 3 and how it answers these four questions. And here is my main thought for the morning. The Bible has a distinct vision of the universe. We're going to start by talking about the where are we question. And the Bible has a distinct vision of this place where we live called the universe. It understands what this place is, why it's here, and how it works. And we're going to spend the next 4 weeks just in Genesis 1. But even in doing that, we can't cover everything because it is such a dense, rich text. This morning, what I'm specifically interested in is this vision of how the world works and what kind of world we live in. In other words, what does Genesis 1 proclaim about the world? And how is that different from what the world around us says? So I wrestled with how to present this. Genesis 1 is so thick, so dense, so rich, so wonderful that I could just read through verse by verse and we would be stuck here until kingdom come. So how do we get through this thoroughly but succinctly? And I think the best way that I can do that is to let somebody else tell you. So I want to start with a video that summarizes Genesis 1, I think, very, very well. And when it's over, I'm going to ask you what stood out to you. And I'm going to ask you to summarize Genesis 1. Let's have a look.
The first book in the Bible is called Genesis.
And we're going to look closely at the first page of the book of Genesis. It's a carefully crafted narrative about God creating and ordering the whole cosmos.
Okay, let's check it out. Now, the opening line of the whole Bible is, "In the beginning, God created the skies and the land."
Now, your Bible translation might say, "the heavens and the earth." In biblical Hebrew, the word for heaven refers simply to the sky above, and the word for earth does not mean globe, but rather the land.
The ground below us.
Right. This line is summarizing what's going to happen in the following narrative, which starts in the next line.
And it reads, "Now the land was wild and waste."
This phrase rhymes in Hebrew. The land was tohu vavohu, which means unordered and uninhabited. This is the ancient way of talking about the pre-creation state, what we might call nothingness. For the biblical authors, non-existence means having no purpose and no order. And the next line uses another image to say the same thing.
And darkness was on the face of the deep abyss. What's the deep abyss?
Yeah, it's a dark, chaotic ocean. It's another common way the ancients describe the non-reality that preceded creation. Now, here's where things start to get interesting. because in the midst of those dark waters, God is present.
And the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters.
The Hebrew word for God's Spirit is ruach, which can refer to wind or breath or God's invisible presence.
So you can't see it, but God is present in the darkness, ready to bring order so that life can flourish.
Yes, and this ordering happens in a series of 6 days.
Each day begins with the phrase, "And God said," and then ends with the phrase, "And there was evening and morning."
Yeah, every day addresses those problems introduced in verse 2, that there's no order and no inhabitants. So on days 1 through 3, God splits apart that unordered darkness into 3 ordered realms. Then, on days 4 through 6, God fills the uninhabited wasteland with creatures.
Interesting. Let's see how that works.
Okay, so the first realm of order begins with light on day 1.
Ah, yes. Let there be light.
This is God's own glorious light that fills and contains the darkness as he separates day from night. God's establishing the order of time.
Okay, and then on day 2, let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water. What's the vault?
In the ancient culture of the biblical authors, the sky was perceived as a solid dome that holds back waters. God's depicted here as splitting the chaos waters in half, above and below, which creates the realms of the sky and the seas.
And then on day 3, let the waters under the sky be gathered into one place and let dry ground appear.
God is establishing the realm of the land, and it emerges out of the chaotic waters. And then there's a bonus creative act on day 3. God invites plants and fruit trees with seed to emerge out of the land.
Okay, so we got the realms of time, the realm of the sky and the seas, and the land. And they all have order.
Right. Now, it's time to go back and fill these realms of days 1 through 3 with inhabitants. And this is what happens on days 4 through 6.
So on day 4, let there be lights in the vaults of the sky.
God installs these lights, the sun, moon, and stars, as signs and symbols that reflect God's own light. He gives them his own royal power to separate day and night.
Then on day 5, let the waters swarm with living creatures, and let birds fly above the land.
Yeah, these are the creatures that live in the waters below, and those that fly near the waters above.
Then finally on day 6, let the land produce living creatures.
They emerge up out of the ground to live on the land. And then, matching that bonus act of creation on day 3, God makes a special land creature, human, or in Hebrew, Adam. Then, God provides all of those plants from day 3 as abundant food.
Now, over and over, God says what he created was good. But then, after making humans, God says that it is very good.
Yes, humanity is the climax of days 1 through 6. And their importance is explained in the first poem in the Bible.
So God created humanity in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them.
So humans come up from the ground like the other land creatures. But they're also more. They're God's image, which means that together, men and women embody and represent the Creator within his creation.
God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it, ruling over the creatures."
This is the purpose of being God's image, to oversee creation as God's partners and representatives in the world.
Very cool.
Now, after the 6 days, we get a concluding line that links back to the key words of the opening line.
And so we're completed, the skies and the land, and all their inhabitants.
Except there's one more day. It stands outside the pattern of days 1 through 6. It's the big climax.
And God completed on the 7th day the work which he had done. And he rested on the 7th day from all the work which he had done. And God blessed the 7th day and set it apart as holy.
So God rests on the 7th day. This is a standard biblical image where God, after ordering the cosmos, comes to rest and dwell in his sacred space. It's like the whole world is a holy temple where God lives with his people.
Now that phrase, "there was evening and morning," it doesn't appear on day 7.
That's right. The 7th day has no end. That's because Genesis 1 is describing God's ideal vision for the whole cosmos.
A place where God lives with his partners to rule the world in harmony forever.
Yes, the 7th day is the goal of creation. It's actually so important that the author of Genesis 1 has woven the number 7 into every part of the story. There are 7 days of creation, 7 announcements that creation is good. There are 7 Hebrew words in the opening verse, and then 2 times 7 Hebrew words in verse 2. And then the statement about the 7th day has 3 lines of 7 words.
Wow. So the first page of the Bible is doing way more than just telling us how the world was made.
Right. Genesis 1 has been designed to show us that God's purpose is to share creation with his images so they can rest and rule it with him forever. And that purpose is what the rest of the biblical drama is all about.
So what stood out to you?
Perfection of what was created.
The perfection of what was created?
At the end of it, the perfection of everything that was created, that everything was as it should be.
All right. All was as it should be.
Well, when it started, it struck me how what an artist God is. You know, like artists will start with nothing and they'll create whatever it is they want to create. And that's just what God was doing. But then Pam, at the end of that, it became abundantly clear to me that God created us with a mission. We're his stewards. I mean, we've got a responsibility. He didn't just create us to ditz around and have fun.
To ditz around. Yeah.
What happened to the water above the land?
What happened to the water above the land? Well, about 5 chapters later, God pokes a hole in the dome and all that water rushes in and floods it. Why? Maybe someday we'll talk about the flood story and we can get into that question in depth. The ages do seem to dwindle slowly down until you get to Moses. Moses lives that 120 years. Seems to be the just right.
I'm not sure what the answer is, but it strikes me he didn't do it all at once. He could have. He could have just said he spoke and everything that was done in 6 days was done immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. And maybe there's a big answer to the why of that, but I don't know what it is. But it's fascinating when you see what he is doing, like painting on a canvas, and the intentionality and the beauty of it, the perfection and the reflection of who he is. And so maybe that's the answer to the why, is to reveal what he's doing.
Yeah, that, and he's not in a hurry. He could have done it just like that. But he seems to take his time.
All the symbolism and all the way it 7 this and 7 that and 7 verbs and 7 that. I knew a little bit about the sevens, but I've never seen them that.
Yeah, there are lots of sevens, more than what they talked about, lots of threes and lots of tens. You begin to think that the writer had help. Perfect order of everything. Now there's a lot of design and intentionality. So what happens in Genesis 1? Somebody summarize the content for me.
He creates the world.
He creates the world. Out of chaos, or out of nothing, or out of the tahom, the deep, I think they use the word, the chaotic ocean. Yeah, it's odd. We don't have time to get into all of that. Yeah, God create, and he doesn't just create the world and its inhabitants. Day 4, what else does he create? Everything outside the world. Yeah, the cosmos. Okay, So the question that I want us to think about, what does Genesis 1 proclaim about the world? We're trying to answer this question, where are we? What kind of world do we live in? And Genesis 1 is making a lot of claims about that, answering that question. But I want to focus on three that I think are especially important for our purposes going forward. This chapter... Okay, I've already said that. So here's the first big claim. And that is that God created the universe. I don't know if that shocks any of you. I imagine it doesn't. But he created it on purpose. What does that tell us? If God created the world on purpose, what does that tell us about the kind of world we live in?
There's an intention. It's not just happenstance.
Okay, there's an intention. There's a reason for it.
There's a purpose.
Yeah.
Wasn't
a big boom.
A plan.
There's a plan. What does it tell us about God?
He's almighty. He can do anything.
He can do anything?
He went to the trouble of making us in his image. So, he's connected more so with us than everything else.
Okay. He has a unique relationship to the human creature. My kids have this book that's like, I can't remember the title of it, but it's basically a collection of the weirdest creatures in existence. The weirdest fish, the weirdest bugs, weirdest birds. Some of them are ugly, some of them do strange things. And I just think about, you know, the blobfish. There's literally a fish called the blobfish out in the ocean somewhere. Why? Why does that thing exist? Well, the answer, in my mind, the only answer is that God wills for it to exist. He enjoys for it to exist. It brings him delight. God creates because he wants to create.
He creates perfection.
He creates perfection. So he doesn't need to create anything. I used to know a preacher who he would say God created the world because he needed someone to love. He wanted someone to love. There's a big problem with that if you believe in a Trinitarian God. And that is, God already has someone to love. God is a self-existing community of love from eternity past. He doesn't create the world because there's a yearning in his heart. There's an absence within God that he needs to fill. God creates, even though he doesn't need to create. Creation exists simply because he wants it to exist. And because he created it, because God created the universe belongs to God. It's his world. And he is responsible for what happens in it. That doesn't mean that he is to blame for everything that happens in the world. It's not that he commits everything that happens in the world, but he's responsible. In the same way, if I get into our vehicle and I take my family, we go to Walmart or whatever, and we park in a parking space, and my kids open the door a little too hard, and it dings the door next to us. Okay, well, I didn't do that, but I'm responsible, aren't I? I now need to go and try to find the owner and make amends, because these are my kids. I'm responsible for them and for what they do. In the same way, the world is God's world. He's responsible for what happens in it. Another way of putting that is, this is his problem. It's not his fault, but it's his problem. But we'll get to what is wrong with the world in a couple of months. So,
not a couple of months. I wonder
Say more about that. Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, he knows what his plans are. He knows that he's going to create man. And if he's going to have, if he's going to create man, he's got to have a place for man to exist.
Okay, so he's creating an environment in which he can place the human creature. What alternatives does this rule out?
That it was happenstance. Big bang.
Okay. Happenstance, big bang. That it happens spontaneously. That there is stuff spontaneously. And there was no God involved. Okay. What other alternatives does this rule out?
That it was evil.
That it was evil? Say more.
Because he declared it good.
Ah, okay. Well, we'll get to the goodness of creation in just a moment.
But it does rule it out that it's not evil, right?
I think the next statement does.
Okay.
Yeah. So we'll come back to that. What other alternatives does this rule out? Imagine yourself as an Israelite. You're in exile. You're living in Babylon. And your kids come home from Babylon Elementary School. And they're telling the story that Babylon teaches. And you say, ah, no, 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 no. Genesis 1. What story did they tell you? And how is it different from this? You don't have to know the whole, like, epic. But they came home saying many gods created the world. And actually, more specifically, and I don't expect anybody to be read up on this, but more specifically, in Babylon, the story of creation is called Enuma Elish. Enuma Elish tells the story of how there was an uprising. You have all the gods up in Godland, and one of the gods, Tiamat, she is the primordial god of chaos. She is the saltwater god. She is the god of the ocean where life cannot. Well, human life is not sustainable out there. It won't be once the humans are created. And she rises up. She's like an evil deity. And all of the gods are cowering in fear until one god, the god Marduk, says, I'll take her down. And if I do, then you'll make me king. And they say, oh, yes, please fight for us. And Marduk blows his mighty wind into her mouth, and she blows up like a big puffer fish, and then he shoots his arrow, which I don't know what the arrow is, lightning or something, and it hits Tiamat and splits her in half. And so now Marduk is the great god of Babylon. He's the high god of Babylon because he defeated Tiamat. And he takes Tiamat's carcass, which is now split in half. He uses half to make the sea, or half to make the sky and half to make the land. And he takes her blood and he mixes it into the dirt and he makes humans. Humans. So, well, an alternative to this is the idea that there were many gods involved. Even if you look at Roman mythology, if you look at Greek mythology, you're going to find various versions of a creation story where there are multiple gods involved. And here, you just have one god. There's no conflict. There's no great war. There is just one God peacefully speaking creation into existence. That's going to have an impact on how that elementary aged Israelite thinks about the world. Why does it matter whether God created the universe or not? What's at stake? No plan. Tell me what you mean by no consistency.
Purpose.
Purpose?
And we have a leader, somebody in charge.
Yeah, somebody who you can beat on their door at 2 in the morning and say, hey, have you seen this problem? I expect you to do something about this. I dinged the door next to me. Yeah. If there is no God, no divinity responsible for the universe, then there is no purpose, there's no direction. All right, another thing that Genesis 1 proclaims about the world, that the universe is good. It's good. Now, seven times God says that it is good. He says the light is good, the dry land, the vegetation, the sun, moon, stars, the birds and the fish, the livestock, and all that he had made. Seven times he says it's good. What does it mean to say it is good?
He's pleased with it.
He's pleased with it?
It delights him.
It's delightful.
He's done what he intended.
It's done what he intended. Yeah. It's fulfilling its design, its purpose. Think about let the earth sprout vegetation, plants yielding seed, and fruit trees bearing fruit, which is in their seed, each according to its kind. It's reproducing on its own. It's doing what it's supposed to do.
And it excludes that it's evil.
It excludes that it is evil. Absolutely. James, were you about to say something?
If you said in contrast to the one time that he said it's not good, and that had to do with man being alone, it's the only time that he says what he created was not good. And it has, so what is good is functional. It is as he intends. It is perfect.
Yeah. You know, the only time that God says it's not good is in chapter 2. And even then, it's not like, oh no, I need to get rid of the human creature. It's, oh no, I didn't make enough. Let me make another. Yeah, it's orderly. It's blessed. It's beautiful. It's dignified. The act of creation, and you could see this visually in the video, it's about creating order as much as anything else. It's taking the disorder, the tohu vavohu of verse 2, and creating clear structure, a structure of time, where with the separating of night and day in verse 1, or day 1, and then the sun, moon, and stars to mark the seasons in day 4. You have the ordering of land creatures, water creatures, and sky creatures. Creation is as much about order as anything else. The universe is not random. It is orderly. It's created skillfully and beautifully. This points to God's wisdom. God is like a wise architect. We use the word artist a couple of times. There's so much artistry in this. And I'd agree, but I don't think God is a painter so much as he's an architect. Also, I would point out the universe is good even before there are humans. It's good unto itself. It's good for there to be dry land, whether there are humans or not. Which means that the goodness of the world does not come from its usefulness to humans. So, what alternatives does this rule out? The matter is evil. That's one of the big ones. I have three answers, and that's the first one. Okay, you have Plato, Greek philosopher. Plato says matter is evil. The Gnostics in the second century, they believe matter is evil. You even seem to have some corners of Christianity where it's like the purpose, the function of the gospel, the function of salvation, is to help us get away from this place. If we could just get away from here and get to somewhere where there's no matter, no molecules, and we're just spirit, that would be wonderful. Well, in Genesis 1, it's good. This is where God created us. And, by the way, in Enuma Elish, the world is made out of the broken pieces of the evil deity Tiamat. So the world is made out of bad parts. It's like the world is faulty from the beginning. Okay, so matter is evil, the world is evil, that's one alternative. What's another alternative that this rules out? We all bring our thinking caps this morning. I'm on my third cup of coffee, so I'm
sleeping. It's not nothing.
It's not neither here nor there. It's not neutral. Yeah. Not neutral. Did I hear somebody over here?
Well, the word I looked up was excellent. So if everything's excellent, it's not gonna come from evil gods. It's not gonna come from evil. I'm bringing it out very well, but it's the best of the best.
Yeah, there's no deficiency, no inferiority in it. So to come back to the idea of it being neutral, there is a narrative that you will find in the world that the universe is just neutral. It's not good, it's not bad, it just is. What kind of ethic might a person have if they think that the world is neither good nor bad, it just is?
Haphazard?
Disregard good, evil.
Just live however they want. Yeah. There's no purpose to live in accordance with. Somebody over here was.
I just have no hope.
There's no hope? Yeah. And doesn't Ephesians 2 say that when you were separated from Christ, you were without hope and without God in the world?
Does that narrative say that it is what you make it in? If it's neither good nor bad, it's what you make.
Like it can be good or it can be bad?
It's all dependent upon man to determine whether it's good or bad.
Perhaps so. I'd have to think more about that. I think if you believe that the universe is a morally neutral, neither here nor there, it just is, kind of place. One thing is opportunism. You got to get while the getting's good. We're just here. Grab what you can. There's a human-centered ethic. The question is, what is best for us? Even though Genesis 1, and we'll get more to the who are we and what's our role and all that. But in Genesis 1, the humans are created as stewards. So it's not a human-centered thing. And then consequence-driven. Rather than asking what is right, we're interested in the impact of our decisions. The ends justify the means, or the ends condemn the means. But we don't need to do what's right, because there is no right. There is no good, there is no bad, there just is. So all we need to think about is trying to achieve the desired ends. Okay, we are running short on time. The third thing that Genesis proclaims about the world is that God's own life animates the universe. So you have days 1 through 3 where God creates light, or really he creates day. Day 2, he creates the vault, but he's making spaces. But there's nothing living in creation until you have the plants that grow up and produce more according to their kind. And then day 4, you have the sun, moon, and stars, which he says they are to rule. They're to rule over, what does it say? Let there be expanse of heaven, let them be for signs, and let them be, God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. Day 5, the waters swarm with living creatures, birds, and then livestock, creeping things, beasts of the earth, and of course humans. Creation is a living thing. It's a living thing. The earth gives birth to livestock in verse 24. The waters give birth to fish in verse 20. The sky to birds. The earth brings forth vegetation And then those things reproduce according to their kind. Meaning that the world is not static. It's going somewhere. There's movement in Genesis 1. Where does that life come from? Well, according to the world, life is an accident. Life is an accident. It is, you have an material, mechanical universe. Inanimate, that's the word I was looking for. An inanimate universe is the setting in the world's story. And then along the way, there's heat and there's water and there's a chemical reaction and lightning or something. There's debate about this. There isn't a settled theory about this. But somehow, out of the inanimate everything, life begins to germinate. It arises somehow mysteriously out of the inanimate stuff. But in Genesis 1, we don't begin with an inanimate world and then life arises. We begin with what? With life, with the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. And then God speaks and he begins to create. So life is actually predates creation. It's not that you have a universe and then life arises out of that. It's that you have life and a universe arises out of life. That's a change. That changes the way that you see things. According to the world, life is the result of water, heat, chemical reactions. And in Genesis 1, life is the result of God endowing creation with his own life. So I would point us to Psalm 104, which is my favorite, one of my favorite psalms, and certainly the best place to go for this. But in Psalm 104, verse 27, he's just listed all of these creatures and their place in the world. And then verse 27, he says, "These all look to you to give them their food in due season. When you give it to them, they gather it up. When you open your hand, they're filled with good things. When you hide your face, they are dismayed. And when you take away their breath, they die and return to their dust. When you send forth your spirit, they are created, and you renew the face of the ground." Things live because God sends forth his spirit. When you breathe, and this whatever life is, and it's pulsing through you and animating your cells and everything, that is somehow it comes from God. We are animated by God's own life, his own spirit. So God created the universe. The universe is good. And his own life animates the universe. What is this? Oh, in case you wanted to know what the questions were. I was wondering what happened to my questions. There they are. All right. The Bible has a distinct vision of the universe. A distinct vision of the universe. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of homework. I'm going to show you five options. You know, you don't have to do any of these because what am I going to do? Flunk you? But this is ways where you might go a little deeper and ingrain these things into yourself. Here are some ways that you can respond to this. And I recommend you not try to do all five. I would recommend you pick one and do that. So you can keep a journal over the coming week where you're reflecting on the main things from today. Just continue to think about these three main ideas. And maybe you just want to write it down. Maybe it's in the notes app on your phone or something. Or maybe you have an actual paper journal that you write in. Another idea is to sit down with your family, whoever's in your household, and have a discussion about what does it mean for something to be good? How do we define what good means? Talk about how the Bible's vision impacts the way that you view the world or what a proper relationship to creation might be. Maybe you're an artist and you want to create a work of art illustrating a moment of your choosing. which is going to require that you dig into the text and pay attention to what's going on in the text and then create something. Maybe you go on a nature walk. Maybe you like to go moving. It's beautiful out this week. Carter's like, done. So take a nature walk and just pause to notice one thing that reminds you of the goodness of God. And then you can read Psalm 104 and use that as a guide for prayer. That's the great creation psalm. It's beautiful, beautiful. All right, let me close us in prayer. Next week, we are going to talk about creation as God's holy temple. Let's say a prayer real quick. Our Father in heaven, may your name be kept holy. We believe that you have created all things. Things in heaven and things on earth. You have made them for yourself. And that all things are ultimately accountable to you. We believe that this is your world. And that you have called it good. Would you help us to identify, to recognize the messages that come our way that are taken for granted in our world, that are contrary to that? Would you give us wisdom and insight as we try to live and discern and see your goodness in the world? Would you help us to recognize and to screen out and to trust in your word? And we pray all of these things in the name of our Lord Jesus. Amen.